welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner. It's Thursday, November 13th, 2014, just after 5:30 UTC. I'm Sam Minter. Yvonne Beau could not make it this week. He's traveling again. I think he's in Chicago or something this week, because I saw him on Facebook complaining about how cold it was. But we once again have Bruce Morton with us.
Hello. Hello, Bruce. Nice. Great to be back.
We got a number of things going on this week. We're gonna touch on the comet landing thing that's been going on. There's been a lot going on with Russia being aggressive in various ways lately. We're gonna talk about net neutrality a bit because that debate sort of came up again this week with Obama making some comments on it. Bruce has a couple of sort of review kind of things with us. He saw Interstellar, which I'm interested in seeing but have not yet seen.
I won't give it away.
I think I've been spoiled. As we've talked about before, when Bruce is on the show, we've got a little bit of genealogy stuff to talk about, and we'll see where that gets us. If we still have time when we've done talking about all those things, we got a couple other things up our sleeves. But that's that'll probably take us a good bit of the way through.
So, you know, at the very end of the last week's show, you all mentioned that you hadn't looked at your download statistics lately.
Yeah.
See how many listeners you have. So I was curious if you had looked at that.
Not since last week, no. It's just one of those things that, like, since the last time I've done it, I changed hosting providers. So the log files are in a different place. I know where they are. I know I could do it. It's just sort of like I have to go and sit down and scan them and do the thing. The trickiest part about this actually is, like, I can't just say how many times has somebody downloaded an MP3 from, you know, the directory where the podcast lives in the last week, because, you know, there's huge numbers of automated robots and things that are constantly scanning everything. There's a big judgment call of, like, what do you count and what do you not count, and do you count this and do you count? And I had, previously when, in the old way I did it, I'd already had sort of a list of common robots I excluded, and I excluded certain addresses that, you know, didn't have names and only had numbers and things like that. And I have no idea how bogus or not that is. It's just sort of a guess. I can probably just repurpose everything I have had before. I don't know. I haven't had the motivation to go do it lately. But since it's come up twice in the last couple of weeks, I will make an effort before the end of this month to look at that again at some point. I mean, typically, you know, it's varied between on the order of a dozen on low weeks, and on high weeks, which were relatively rare, jumping up as high as 50. But that's, like I said, pretty rare. Normally probably around 20 something in a week. And, you know, and that's, who knows, like, yeah, that could just be people who hit play for like 5 seconds and then they're like, whatever. As opposed, because you can't tell, did they listen to the whole thing, did they listen to part? So it's, who knows. As I've said before, like, you know, obviously even at the high end of that, even if it was 50 people every week, that's like tiny. You know, no one would do this, you know, just for, you know, it's not like, you know, we're going to make money off it or sell advertising or anything else like that. Nobody cares about 50 people listening, except maybe the 50 people listening, and, you know, we have fun doing it. So,
yeah, I enjoy it. I've been listening to it for 2 years now, and it's you'll be appalled, but I learn a lot about the news from you all.
Well, we appreciate your listenership, and we know of two or three other fairly regular listeners who at least a couple times a year chime in and send us an email. So we appreciate all of you regulars. So let's start out. There was a landing on a comet. I guess within the last 24 hours, as we're recording this.
Yes.
And as we're recording this, also they're in sort of a dark period. They landed on the comet, and then they realized that they had landed and were collecting data, but maybe they weren't quite tethered as well as they thought they wanted to be.
And, well, they weren't at all.
So they're waiting to see when it comes back. I guess it was out of communication, expectedly out of communication, for a number of hours, and they're waiting to see when it comes back. Is it still where they left it, or is it like tumbling around the surface, or is it doing something else? You know, so
yeah, because as part of the landing sequence, I don't know if you've seen the animation, is that as it gets close to the comet, it shoots these this tether like barbs into the comet, and then it ropes itself in to attach itself, and that whole mechanism didn't work. And right. So and reports are that it hit the surface. It didn't like hit the surface hard, but it bounced off the surface. And yep. So it, you can imagine the gravity on this thing. It's very, very low. So, and it said that it took probably a couple of hours for it to actually stop bouncing. Can you imagine? So.
No, that's great. Well, they actually had three things. They had the harpoons that you were talking about. There was also essentially a rocket motor kind of thing that was supposed to also help push it in once it got there. And then it had, I guess, some ice, what they call ice screws, that were supposed to screw into the ice. And of those three things, the only one that worked properly were the ice screws. The other two failed. But that's, you got to think with all of these things. I mean, this thing was launched over a decade ago. The planning for it was another 5 or 10 years before that. Mm-hmm. It's been on its way there for 10 years. Somebody gave the analogy of like, imagine leaving your car somewhere for 10 years and then walking up and expecting it to start on the first try. So it's kind of remarkable that the engineering is good enough that, anything works. But, we've actually gotten pretty good at these things. The Voyager spacecraft are still out there plugging along. They were launched in the
70s,
mid-70s or so. They actually...
Well, the Pioneer, there was first the Pioneer. Yeah. But, and then the Voyagers.
Yeah, and I think, did we finally lose contact with Pioneer? I forget.
I don't know.
I know it was still giving us signals like 5 years ago, but I lost track if it still is today. But yeah, these things keep going and going and going and going and going. We've gotten a better and better record. I mean, we've got these Mars rovers going that have now been there for years.
Over a decade, and they're still operational.
Yeah, the earlier Mars rovers. Yeah, absolutely. Or, well, one of the two is still operational.
Yeah.
It's the nominal lifespan was supposedly much, much less. But of course, they over engineer these things as much as they can, and they're still plugging along.
Have you seen the video that the European Space Agency came up with? Like, it was like a public, it was like a publicity video. You wouldn't know if you started looking at this thing.
Okay.
It was very, very, very well done. I have to say, the Europeans definitely have a sense of style. it's basically the kind of thing where it's the two people are out in this desolate planet. And there's a master and an apprentice, and the apprentice is trying to form, these objects in the sky, and the master gives the apprentice a test, and they're forming these planets in the sky, and just by chance they kind of mention the Rosetta thing, landing on a comet, and it's really, really cool. I don't have a link for it, but I can send it to you.
Yeah, definitely. Send it or tweet it or whatever, and because I have not seen that one. But anyway, so it's interesting to see these accomplishments still continue to come up. I guess one of the next ones that's coming up is the Pluto flyby is going to happen in a few months, I guess. We're getting much closer to that. And then I'm not sure what else is next on the agenda. People talk about, we talked about the problem with Spaceship Two last week or whenever. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of things going on with the manned spaceflight program, and we're sort of in a lull in terms of manned spaceflight. But the robots have been doing all kinds of exciting stuff for years. And it looks like that's going to continue, and certainly from a cost benefit point of view, I mean, it's a lot cheaper to send robots all over the place than it is to try to send humans.
Oh yeah.
And yes, you don't get quite the same thrill of some guy stepping on Mars for the first time. But you get all kinds of good information. You get all kinds of things. And I think if anything, if we had to have this trade-off, I'd rather have a ton more robots and less of the manned programs at the moment. Because there are all kinds of other places that are, I'd like to visit more. It'd be good to see more of Titan, more of Europa. There are a few, the stuff, we've got Galileo around Saturn, but it's nearing the end of its mission. There are all kinds of fun things that it would be interesting to see. And I think some of the most interesting, I mean, we've spent lots and lots and lots of effort on Mars. The moons of Saturn and Jupiter are actually...
More. Europa and...
There's a lot more there that... there's good science to be done in all of these places, but we've had a lot less in those environments because we've been concentrating so much on Mars lately. I'm like, okay, let's do the outer planets some more.
Well, the reason for all the interest in Mars is because it's the only other place in the solar system. Well, it's one of the few places in the solar system where life possibly could have been, and so far, we've discovered that there has been running water on Mars, but still no signs that there was life, no fossils.
Right. And that's one of the things, too. I mean, you know, Europa and Titan and some of these other places are actually also prime candidates for that kind of stuff because of some of the dynamics that are going on in those places. There may be underground water oceans on Europa. Titan is full of hydrocarbons that could be precursors to all kinds of things. It's a lot less potentially Earth-like necessarily, but still with a lot of the right ingredients to have interesting things happening. Anyway, it's good to see those things continuing. I've been, of course, a space fan geek since I was young, so I'd love to see a lot more of it. But it's
one of those things where the libertarian in me is kind of like screaming, no, but the science geek in me is like, yeah, let's keep doing these things.
Well, the way to trade it off, I guess, is if you look at it, especially like I said, the unmanned stuff, if you look at the price tags compared to almost anything else the government spends money on, it's a really small, trivial amount compared to all of these other things. So it's easier to justify. It's let's just get rid of, two or three more fighter planes, and we can fund a couple hundred new space probes,
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, yeah, and it's sad, but yeah, that is very true. Yeah, F-35 being probably fund NASA for the next 20 years with what we've done with F-35 alone.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a break and we'll move on from space, and we'll talk about Russia for a little while. So we'll be back right after this. This is Sam here with an opportunity for you. Yes, you heard me right, an opportunity. For you loyal listeners of Curmudgeon's Corner, every once in a while, Yvonne can't make a show. and I do a solo show, which, you know, I think I do okay. But, you know, it's always interesting to have a second person to bounce off. And just in general, sometimes it's good to hear another voice. If you, yes, you, have some things to say about the kinds of things we usually talk about on Curmudgeon's Corner, you know, politics, current events, news, tech, then drop me a line at abelsmay@abelsmay.com letting me know. And hey, I'll keep you in mind and maybe ask if you can join us sometime, either on a regular show with Yvonne if it's something particularly pressing that you maybe have an expertise on, or just, you know, hey, an opportunity to co-host when Yvonne is out. Who knows? Now, I am not guaranteeing that if you send me an email, you'll definitely get on the show, but let me know if you're interested, and I'll keep you in mind. Thanks, and now, back to the show. And here we are. So, you know, when we were talking right before the show started, Bruce, you mentioned something about Russia sending patrols over the Gulf of Mexico, and I'm like, I hadn't even heard that. So before we talk about the rest of it, what's going on with that?
Okay, so this is... this came out today, and this is just a sign of how Russia is trying to do a tit for tat for what we're doing right next door in Ukraine. And it says in a show of military. Well, let me read the headline. It says Russian bomber patrols to reach Gulf of Mexico. It says in a show of military muscle amid tensions with the West, Russia will send long-range strategic bombers on regular patrol missions across the globe, from the Arctic Ocean to the Gulf of Mexico, a top official said Wednesday. The announcement by Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu came as NATO's chief accused Russia of sending fresh troops and tanks into eastern Ukraine. And this is from the AP.
And, of course, we've got, Russia being aggressive in the Ukraine, and, of course, you know, arguably there are provocations there, too. You've got Russia in general taking a much more adversarial position in a number of different places than it had been for a while. I mean, this trend has been, moving in this direction for a number of years now, but there was sort of an interim time period going up through, through the George W. Bush administration, at least, where sort of Russia was, you know, doing stuff, but they were kind of in their own little world. And they've been increasingly aggressive over the last few years.
The Berlin Wall came down 25 years ago, days ago. Yeah, this week.
Yeah.
So it's taken 25 years for them to, recover. I don't know about recover fully, but I mean, they've strengthened their economy. They've liberalized in a lot of areas. They still have, strong leaders and not nearly the freedoms that we enjoy here in the West, but it's just a matter of what we're used to. We're not used. We've been 25 years. We're used to Russia being no longer a superpower,
right?
But and so we've been able to basically go around the world, do whatever we want for the last 25 years, and now all of a sudden we're seeing someone pushing back, and we go, and we're not able we're all of a sudden shocked. And
I mean, the dynamic you have is, we complain about Putin and him being very authoritarian, but he's very well supported in the populace. That's certainly not universal, but it's not like he's unpopular. Because fundamentally, you've got sort of the mindset of, the whole country felt defeated and humiliated by the end of the Cold War. Now, on the one hand, there were a lot of things about Soviet Russia that a lot of the populace did not like and were very happy to have gone. But at the same time, there was just this sort of nationalistic, hey, we were one of the two most important powers in the planet. We were powerful. We were doing this. We were doing that. And we were, in a commanding position. And then all of a sudden, we're sort of laid low. And so there was very much this sort of people feeling missing the old days and feeling nostalgic about how things used to be. And, you know, not necessarily liking the fact that they went from, you know, the superpower to being something else. And so when you get a leader who comes in place, you know, saying, you know, we're not going to be pushed around, we're taking control, we're going to do what we want to do and screw those other guys, you know, that's very popular, you know, type of position. I mean, and, you know, of course you can make, I don't want to make too deep an analogy here, but of course this is the kind of thing that happened after World War One that led to the rise of the Nazis, is because after World War One, Germany was very heavily punished and left in a very inferior position with all kinds of problems and
really rubbed it in the face at the end of World War One.
Yeah. What was that?
Yeah, we really rubbed it in the face against the Germans after World War One.
Yeah, and a lot of people have made the direct connection, and, you know, and there's of course debate over this like any historical thing, but a lot of people have made the argument that, you know, that treatment after World War One was a big portion of what led to World War Two. And hopefully we're not quite in the same position here, you know, we definitely have a situation where, you know, Russia and many Russians are a bit resentful of how the last 25 years have gone, and they'd like something else, and to have a little bit of restoration to where they were. Now, how much can they pull that off or not? I don't know. As Yvonne has said on these shows a number of times, you know, just the sanctions that we've put on in the last year are hurting economically in Russia. But, you know, the thing is, the behaviors, that's not necessarily going to change anything here. Because,
well, you know, the Russians, they have their own sanctions that they can do, and they can really put Europe in a real pain, because they get a lot of their energy from there.
Absolutely.
And Europe will freeze without Russian oil.
They absolutely could cause a lot of pain going in the other direction. But also, you know, the sort of notion of, well, what are all these sanctions for? Are you actually trying to change Russian policy, or are you just trying to punish them for what they've done? Because, okay, you can punish them for what they've done, but if your goal is actually to have the Russians engage in behavior that's sort of, you know, a bit more friendly to the world community or whatever, I think you're more likely to have the opposite effect, because they're going to dig in. Because it's going to be, you know, you're once again, the West is trying to control what we're doing. They're trying to impose their agenda. They're trying to do this. They're trying to do that. And so screw them. We're going to do what we want to do. And if it costs us, if our economy suffers, if we have difficulties, well, you know, we've had difficulties before. We'll live through it, but we're going to do what we need to do for our interests.
Yeah, and when the wall came down, when Warsaw Pact went away, Gorbachev asked that we not expand NATO, and then at that time, I'm not sure exactly what the name, or maybe it was Bush or someone else in the administration, they said, oh no, we won't expand. But then we went ahead and expanded anyway. And so now here we are trying to expand NATO all the way to Ukraine. I think maybe in the last few months, there hasn't been much talk of putting Ukraine into NATO. But
right.
But there we are. We got NATO troops going, helping Ukraine out. And that's just totally unacceptable to them, and especially, you know, when we helped, you know, our CIA caused a coup there in Ukraine, and we installed our own guys, and it was the Russians who actually caught our own diplomats talking about it ahead of time, and put those recordings out, and lo and behold, turned out to be the yachts, the guy who who we had picked turned out to be and became the president there of Ukraine.
Yeah. Now, to be fair, those recordings, you know, can be interpreted in a few different ways in terms of how deeply we're involved. However, you'd be crazy to think that we're not trying to do, you know, everything possible to influence things in the direction that we thought was in our own interest. But what happens in so many of these cases is when we do that, it's incredibly short-sighted. And by the fact that we're interfering, we end up causing more problems, you know? Pick the guy we think is going to be the guy who's going to support us the most or whatever, but, you know, it's like, it's just, whenever we intervene like this, it just, the overwhelming tendency is for such things to backfire.
Yeah.
And it seems, why don't we just, for once, I know, crazy thought, just keep our fingers out of it and see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, it's not our in our interest.
Now, of course, the counter argument is, of course, that, you know, if we keep our fingers out of the pot, well, of course, the Russians are going to control it just the same way we would have, except now it's going to be their interest served instead of ours, because the sort of Platonic ideal of the country deciding for itself with no external influence just doesn't exist.
Yeah, well, so what if Russia influences Ukraine? It's not in our backyard. It's their backyard, and yeah, it may be bad what Russia would do if we were not involved at all. But it's going to be a lot worse if we try to have a proxy war or even some direct war between NATO and Russia. Are you crazy? There's never been a war between two nuclear power countries. Do we really want that? Heck no.
Yeah, the closest we've gotten is border skirmishes between India and Pakistan, and they have been remarkably self-contained. And you know, a strong argument can actually be made that the presence of nuclear weapons in those two countries has reduced the amount of conflict between them because they realize what the stakes are. But you would hope that, you know, in the sort of Russia versus U.S. in these areas, I mean, I know it's not, you know, on the one hand, it's like, I want all the best for Ukraine. All the best is probably not represented by Russian control. However, is it worth fighting Russia over? No. You know, and if push comes to shove and Russia's willing to put troops on the ground and take over, which it certainly seems they are. I mean, over the last few weeks, they've been once again sort of with their trying to deny it publicly, but sending all kinds of tanks and armored weapons into eastern Ukraine. And are we willing to, you know, do any sort of on the ground fight to try to counter that? No, and we shouldn't be, you know.
And we know how the history since World War II, these halfway fights that we try to get into, you know, Korea, Vietnam, and all the others, where we try to, you know, to fight a halfway war, not all the way, then that's it, we're never able to win that. You're either all in or not at all.
Yeah, and this is one where being all in would be a fairly significant commitment that we probably don't want to go to.
No.
But yeah, and you get all these people jumping up and down and saying, well, then you can't actually say that. You can't actually do that because then there's nothing stopping the Russians from just taking over. And are we just going to lay down and let that happen? And, you know, maybe. And you know, of course, the people bring up the World War II analogies and say, well, you're just talking appeasement. And what if we decided that, you know, whatever was going on with the Nazis wasn't any of our business and hadn't gotten involved in World War II at all, you know, and had let the Nazis take over all of Europe, you know, wasn't it the right thing to do to intervene in that case, even though there weren't, again, just like there weren't direct U.S. interests in Europe? And it's hard to weigh those arguments, but I tell you, I lean very hard in the direction of, you know, unless there's an absolutely clear-cut case that there's no other choice and that our involvement would clearly make things better, I don't think we should be there. And my worry, and I've said this on the show before, is like, no matter what the best intentions are, what tends to happen is that when we get involved, we actually make the situation worse. More people end up dying than if we just said, sorry, we're not involved.
Yep. And I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot more about this as the debates start happening in the summer next year.
Yeah. And I currently don't see, you know, there are a few interesting bits. Like, Russia is actually actively cooperating with us on the negotiations with Iran. And behind the scenes, obviously, they cooperated with us on getting the Syria chemical weapons deal struck. So there are areas of cooperation still happening. But I think the overall tendency is clearly that the Russians want to make clear their sphere of influence and push the West out of what they believe is sort of rightfully theirs. And that certainly, at a bare minimum, is, you know, the former Soviet Union, which of course includes Ukraine.
Or at least the countries that border them. I mean, not Poland, you know, Poland's in NATO, okay, leave it alone. But
they haven't been rumbling about the Baltic states either, even though those were part of the Soviet Union. But the Ukraine is much, you know, dearer to the Russian heart, I guess, is or something like that.
Yeah. Well, especially since half the country is Russian.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll see what happens there. Let's take another break, and we'll come back and we'll talk about net neutrality for a bit. Back after this.
This is a break, oh yes, this is a break. This is a break, cause no one gave me any suggestions. I told you, I warned you, so this is a break. This is a wonderful break, a wonderful break. Yes, indeed, this is a break. This is a break in the middle of Curmudgeon's Corner. Yes, this is a break. Yes, yes, this is a break. Break, 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 break. Yes, 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 this is a break. Yes, this is a break. Break, 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 break. Yes, it is a break. And now the break is over.
And here we are. So, one of the things here, and I mentioned when I was planning the show with Bruce earlier, Yvonne and I have had our occasional conversations about net neutrality, although it's probably been a couple months. But I'm actually very curious, Bruce, to hear your take on it, because of course, there are conflicting things here too. There's the keep government out period. Any regulation is bad, and then there's some other interests too, and I know you're coming from a libertarian perspective, but I've actually heard, even from a libertarian perspective, people have different takes on this. So what are your thoughts on the whole issue?
Well, I'm the libertarian view on this, and that is that the enforced regulations on the networks that are owned by private companies are illegitimate. That's forcing companies. If you have a company that is abusing its customers by allowing certain data in and charging a fee on other data providers or other data sources, then that potentially will anger customers. And so those who are unsatisfied will look for other sources of internet providers. And really, there's more internet providers out there all the time. Traditionally it's been either the phone companies or cable companies, but now more for the phone companies, the cellular companies are getting involved.
So this is one of the...
Or even internet from the sky.
This gets to one of the arguments that always come up here, is that while you're right, there are a whole bunch of different industries that potentially do this and can do this, and there has been some expansion in their area, there's all kinds of obstacles for actual competition in this space. And you know, government is actually one of the biggest ones because they are there are all kinds of local monopolies granted for broadband service because you've got the last mile problem and people have to string wires and get right of ways and stuff like this. And so I forget the exact statistics, but in the vast majority, for the vast majority of the population of the United States, there's only one choice if you want true high-speed internet, and usually there are a few other low-speed choices. And then, you know, there are a few other places where there are two real choices, but it is fairly limited. And there's also, even if you take government out of it, although they've got there's a significant portion of the blockage is caused by government-granted monopolies. But even if you take it out of it, there's a really high barrier to entry in this space.
Oh yeah.
The other thing to add there is people make the argument that okay, private companies own all of this. However, there was a significant government bootstrap to get them there in the first place. And does any residual obligation come from that?
Well, yeah, I agree that government should not have been involved in that in the first place. But if the companies, but that pales compared to the investments that those companies have been putting forward since then. And yes, it's the case now that most people have only one option when it comes to high-speed internet. But I can guarantee you that that will remain a single choice if the government tries to turn internet service into a utility. And so it will be just like a utility where there's not a single provider and it'll be highly regulated. Mm-hmm. And whereas if we allow the free market to continue, then other choices will appear. And there's already other technologies that are being developed for going around these traditional sources of internet. You know, there's satellites, low Earth orbit satellites, or balloons, or even through planes, robotic planes that provide internet over a citywide area.
Yeah, and it's actually companies like Google and Facebook who've been doing the research into those kinds of things, like the balloons and the blimps and all that. Google's been doing a lot of work along those lines.
So if they know ahead of time that once they put up their internet service from the sky, that the government will come in and say, well, now you've got to provide it in this form and with fair access, and you can't charge for premium access to the data providers. So then that will reduce the profit potential for those new avenues, and so they'll simply never appear, and we'll never know about the ways that the different ways that we could be getting internet service if net neutrality becomes the law of the land.
So I'll tell you where I've come at this before is, I would say my number one preferred way to deal with this situation is actually not enforce net neutrality rules, but is do everything possible to lower the barrier of entry to allow new competitors. So get rid of local government monopolies on this. Basically make it a lot easier for new entrants to come into this space, so that if you do have, Comcast has incredibly horrible customer service and everyone agrees with that, make it easy for someone to come in and say, well, we'll do it better. And because right now that's very hard. So that's my first choice. My second choice is still, it is you know, I'm okay with the idea of, you know, let's make it a utility like landline phone lines and like electricity and stuff like that. But I'm very wary of that. That's why it's my second choice. Because A, as we all know, government has a tendency to completely screw these things up. So what they'll do is they'll put in regulations in place that represent today's technology and sort of freeze it into place and make it really hard to innovate on top of that. Or otherwise just screw it up. So I don't really like that option, but I think it's better than the status quo, potentially.
Why? What's wrong with the status quo? Don't you like your internet the way it is? I mean, is it slow? Do you think it's expensive, or do you feel like there's any kind of filtering being done by your ISP? I haven't heard of that.
There are a few. Like, I know that if I don't change my default DNS from my current provider, if I go to a domain that doesn't exist, they hijack my connection and take it to their own search page instead of another thing. That doesn't bother me a huge amount. There was just this thing with Verizon and AT&T, both on the wireless, inserting their own tracking headers into the stream, so that it's not even coming from the site you're going to, but they're adding their own tracker that's is easily blockable or traceable. So there are things that, the telecommunication companies do all kinds of icky things, and they have, and they're well known for their horrible customer service and things like that. And I think that, again, my first choice is actually move in the direction of deregulation, so a lot more entrants can come in and compete against them and force them to do better. That's absolutely, positively my first choice.
Mm-hmm.
My second choice is go ahead and slap some rules on them to restrict at least the worst of that possible bad behavior. Because the other thing I see is they're not doing what they've been doing the last couple years is continuously testing the waters and seeing if they can get away with a little bit more or a little bit more or a little bit more of sort of these bad behaviors that the net neutrality folks are always warning against. Now, they haven't moved too far in that direction yet, but it's been clear from their actions that they would like to continue going further in those directions. And I'm not sure, like, I would love to think that the actual thing is if they went too far, there would be a public reaction against them and they would be forced to change, or new competitors would come in that would do it better. But what I worry about is, A, the barriers for entry are so high that it would be hard to get an effective competitor in there. And B, the public is very fickle about these things, so there might be a little blow-up of outrage, and then, you know, they step back a little bit in public, and then once things have died down again, they do everything they wanted to anyway and continue going forward, because the self-correcting mechanism of the market doesn't work well when it's really hard to get the competitors in place, and or the kinds of things that are being done are the kinds of things that you have to really be paying attention to notice the difference, or to notice the difference in real time. Like, you'll know the difference like 6 years down the road when you're like, hey, how did this get so crappy? But you won't notice the incremental steps along the way. And so that's why I think if just allowed to be complete, just let things go as they are, leave them unchecked, I'm not 100% sure. I hope that you are right and that the free market will do its will anyway, and that we'll get to a better place regardless. But I fear that if just let to run its course without any changes whatsoever, we'd get something that we're really not that happy with 5 or 10 years down the road.
Well, you know, you have to, another way to look at the at this is, you know, a lot of people have, in the news, they look at this as a conflict between big business on one side trying to impose its will against the consumer, with the little guy who just wants to get his internet. And well, that's not really true. You have big business interests on
other big business
interests. Against other big business interests, because there are big businesses out there that don't want net neutrality, namely Netflix and Amazon and Google, all those that are trying to get into your pipes that are provided by.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting to see some of those, like Google, for instance. A few years back was a very staunch defender of net neutrality. They've really backed off a lot from that now because they've started to realize that there are things they want to do that aren't particularly neutral themselves. Mm-hmm. And the place where net neutrality really potentially helps with is brand new people entering into spaces because it helps give them an even playing field with the established people. Whereas the things that people are so afraid of are that the established players, whether it be the Googles or the Comcasts or the Verizons, are going to basically stack the deck to make it so that their own services and or services that are paying them large amounts of money get favored and it's much harder for the new guys to break in. That's what people are really worried about. But you know, again, I think the government imposing the net neutrality rules is a poor second choice for me. I think the real answer, and the one that unfortunately not very many people are talking about, is the, you know, let's get rid of all of the things that stop other players from entering. Because I want the market to be able to do its job. I want the market to be able to say, Comcast sucks. They provide a horrible experience. So let's come into that market and compete against them. But I think, you know, net neutrality aside, just customer service and what Comcast provides, I mean, is universally loathed by their customers and has been for a decade. Mm-hmm. But in most markets, you don't see, you know, a really vigorous live competition. Now, yeah, okay, you have DirecTV, you have satellite, you have a few other things, but you haven't seen a real flourishing of, you know, let's put in other models and let's try innovative things. And so I think the current structure as it is actually anti-competitive because it entrenches a lot of these monopolies or near monopolies and makes it very difficult for new guys to get in. So if we had any sort of change to happen, the change I would advocate are things to try to break that down, to make it easier for the new guys to get in. Because then you absolutely could have what you're talking about and saying, you know, if one of these providers does something that's not good for the consumers will find something else and they'll go out of business. And so they won't do it. And my fear is just that right now, the situation as it exists, the status quo, there's too many barriers for that market to work efficiently enough to actually solve that problem.
Yeah, but if you impose net neutrality regulations,
you think it'll get worse?
Well, it's going to get worse because that will be a barrier to entry for new service providers.
Yeah,
and so the service providers that we have will become real utilities, and they will treat us just like
utilities. Yeah, because how much innovation do you see coming out of the electric company?
Exactly.
You know, and, you know, Yvonne and I talked about that a few weeks ago with regard to solar and other alternative energies where, you know, the traditional utilities are, you know, dragging their feet as much as they can. And because they're structured to be safe and staid and to provide what they provide and no more. and they're not incentivized to innovate either. So yeah, I mean, I see a lot of cost there. I mean, and this is one of my frustrations with this whole issue, is that aside from my miraculous world that suddenly makes it really easy to go up and compete against Comcast, I see all of these options as bad. You know, I see if government came in and said, imposed, all internet providers must live by these four rules no matter what, blah, 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 they're going to screw it up. They're going to do it badly. They're going to have the kinds of anti-innovative results you're talking about. Although you may get some benefits from it in exchange, but you are going to have that cost. And meanwhile, I also see, like, if you leave it alone and you do nothing, I see the trends towards the telcos doing all kinds of non-desirable things with how they structure internet service as accelerating over the next 5 to 10 years as well. So I don't see either of those as good options, and which is why, again, I wish that more people were talking about, you know, the right answer here isn't any of that stuff. The right answer here is, you know, let's eliminate all of the local monopolies on cable service. Let's you know, I don't know what else you would do. That would go a long way. But also, you know, you could have other potential incentives or tax breaks or something to encourage new competition in these areas or new innovation in these areas if you wanted to go further along those lines. But even just, you know, breaking the existing locally granted monopolies would go a long way.
Well, those cable companies, it's a natural monopoly. No competitor is going to want to string wire to every home. That's just not going to happen.
Well, not entirely true, because you've seen them start to do that. You've had, some Google of the phone companies have been, they obviously have a network already, but they've been adding higher speed internet and fiber along those lines too. You've had Google wiring several cities with fiber at this point too. I think there are players out there that, if given the opportunity, would expand into that space if it was easier to do so.
Yeah.
And obviously you've got people trying to do satellite internet and things like that too, but they've got sort of natural deficiencies in terms of speed and latency and other things that make it hard to compete. You've got the wireless providers also expanding. If the wireless networks continue to expand out, it may well be that in another 5-10 years, you know, you just have your wireless plan from your cell provider, and you don't need landline internet to your home, because that's good enough. It covers your home and everything you need to do too. So there are elements out there. It's very hard right now, and there are a lot of built-in barriers, and a lot of them are government-imposed barriers that I think. And one of the issues there, it's not necessarily federal barriers. There are lots of local restrictions on these things as well. If you got them out of the way, you'd have more innovation there too. And even talking about the Aereo or whatever that was doing the antenna-based internet delivery, and was struck down by the Supreme Court.
I was so sad to see that not come to fruition. I was so looking forward to joining that service.
Yeah, and that's exactly the kind of innovation too. That, like, you know, why was this kept out? This was an innovative, cool service, and it was knocked out because of existing legislation that's on the books for the purpose of protecting existing distribution services like cable companies. And the Supreme Court probably correctly ruled that Aereo was, you know, trying to, you know, scoot around the law.
Yeah, because it was kind of like a technical, you know, what was a workaround? Because if you looked at their servers, they had like thousands of little antennas.
Right.
And it's like, it was totally inefficient. You know, why would you want to have everyone have their own antenna when you could have just one big antenna recording everything? But no, everyone's got their own antenna. So that's not, there's nothing wrong with that.
Right. And it, you know, it's like, okay, you're trying to get around a technicality, and this court could have gone either way, but I couldn't completely see the point of view of saying, you know, as the law is written, clearly you should be covered by the law. But the problem was, it's a bad law. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's not the court's place to say that. But it's still a bad law. The only reason for that law to be there is to help the existing system continue to be the existing system. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that need to just get out of the way, so that people can experiment with this kind of, you know, change in distribution mechanisms. And obviously that's television. They were still relying on the internet infrastructure, but I think the same arguments could apply on people providing that internet connection in the first place.
And that's why I don't watch local TV. I'm a cable cutter. If I can't get it through my internet connection, I don't see it. So I don't watch local news.
You can still use rabbit ears.
Oh, come on! No, I'm in Lake Stevens. I tried that and it just doesn't work. It's too far.
Oh, you need like a big, huge 30-foot antenna on top of your house.
Yeah, I'd have to like put it up in the attic, and yeah, I could do that, but it's just it's not worth it.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I have not cut the cord yet, but I keep arguing with my wife that we should. So I think it's only a matter of time. But
oh man, I've been a cord cutter for about 8 years,
and don't miss it, right?
And I don't miss it at all.
Yeah,
everything is Netflix and just streaming stuff, and I see everything I want. If I want to watch a TV series, it's on there. I can watch it.
Yeah, and if it's not right away, it will be before too long, and you know. Yeah, there are very, very few things at this point that I could get only via the full cable connection, and so
the biggest thing that I used to miss was sports, but even that is becoming it's on there because I can get ESPN now streaming. So,
right,
I'm all set.
There you go. Okay, let's take a break. We'll come back and. We'll hear about movies and genealogy and things like that. Back after this.
Ready for the test, Dracula?
I'm ready, Frankenstein. Then let us begin.
Creepy Classic celebrates the classic horror and science fiction films from the silent era through the 1960s, and retro TV horror from the 1950s to the 1970s. Visit creepyclassics.com for all your classic video needs. And when you buy something, tell Ron that the curmudgeons say hello.
Okay, we're back. So let's start with a movie. You went to see Interstellar, and I'll tell you what I've seen. So first of all, the first thing I ever heard about this movie.
Well, this is first of all.
Yeah.
This in the 2 years that I've been listening, you've never done a movie review. So.
That's true. I think Yvonne may have mentioned one movie once a long time ago, but it's not a usual thing we do. We don't usually review books that we've read or movies that we've watched or anything like that. Now, I'm not a super big movie goer anyway, although I've been watching more on Netflix lately. I've got my little system where I watch my TV shows, my streaming. I've added movies into the mix. So I've watched a few lately.
You don't do Prime?
I have that too, but I have my order of operations is if I want to watch a particular thing, my first choice is Netflix. My second choice is Amazon streaming if it's available. My third choice, since we do have Comcast for TV right now, is if it's available streaming on Comcast, on Xfinity or whatever. And then my fourth choice is I buy it from Apple.
So I'm just trying out Prime now to see how it is compared to Netflix, and so I'm curious to see if what other people's experiences between the libraries of the two, whether you know one is if there's a lot of overlap or if there's a better selection on one or the other.
Well, I won't speak to those two specifically, but the general feedback and frustration I've heard from most people about these services, and you know, throw into the mix like you know Hulu and some of these others as well, is actually frustration on how little they overlap. I mean, obviously, like there are a bunch of things they overlap on, especially if you're looking at older things, things that have been around for a while and aren't super popular. But if you're talking about newer, more current stuff, very often one or another of them has, you know, an exclusive deal for a little while. And so while there certainly are things that overlap and are on everything, you can't just, you know, sort of say, well, which service is best? And I'll just go to that for everything. Because depending on the specific thing you're looking at, it might be on this one or it might be on that one or it might be on neither of them. And, you know, because all of these services are trying to figure out how to compete with each other. And one of the things they're looking to do is make exclusive content deals, which, of course, is great for them because it's potentially a driver. Well, I have to get service X because they're the only ones that have this particular show that I want to watch. Mm-hmm. But for the consumer, it actually sucks because you want to just pick one, you know, subscribe to that one and get everything there.
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, that's my tiering. If it's a, you know, cause I am a Netflix member. I am a Prime member. So if it's available for free streaming on one of those and I have Comcast. So if it's available free streaming on any of those three things, that's my first choice. If it's not available, free in quotes, since I pay for all of those things in a different way, but with a monthly subscription as opposed to for individual pieces of content. But if it's not on any of those three, then I'll buy it from Apple. And the reason I buy it from Apple rather than buying it from one of the others is because the integration works better in terms of being able to watch it on any one of my devices. Although the others have made strides in that area too, but anyway,
Interstellar.
Interstellar. I just want to say the first thing I heard about the movie was when they were talking about physicist Kip Thorne doing the black hole simulations that are in this movie and making sure that they were as close to right as possible given current understanding of physics, and that in fact, in the course of building the simulations for the movie, they learned some new physics and published several papers about the behavior of the clouds coming into black holes that had not been known before based on the simulations done for this movie. And I was like, well, that's good enough for me. I want to see this movie. Forget about anything else about it. I want to see the black hole simulation.
Yeah. The imagery of the black hole looked different than any other visual I'd seen before. You know, typically you see it looks like, you know, and back in the Disney black hole movie, it looks like, you know, water going down a drain, but yep. It doesn't look like anything like that in this movie. And it's really cool.
Yeah, no. But then, you know, the movie actually came out and I started seeing a lot of people, there were some people going, oh, it's wonderful, it's wonderful, it's great, it's great. But then you also had a very vocal minority saying, you know, the story sucked. All the physics was wrong, except the black hole simulation. All the other physics was really bad. And I could forgive that, but the story sucked too.
Those
are a bunch of spoil sports. It was a lot of fun.
That's a really good story. Okay. It is a really good story. It's about a father and his daughter and their connection. And you have this whole adventure of going off into space. And I don't want to say anything other than I've never seen a movie that has portrayed the concepts of time dilation, gravity wells, time distortion in gravity wells, it's really a good story, and you know, exploring different types of worlds, and I watched it with my wife, who's not really the best, you know, the biggest science fiction fan, and she just loved the story. And as far as appropriate for this for kids, we didn't bring our 11-year-old, but it would have been totally appropriate for him. And although it would have been interesting, it would have been difficult to explain to him all these. Well, it would have been a good way to, good reason to explain some of these deeper laws of physics of relativity and such. But I thought it was a really, really good story. And yeah, some of the aspects of the science fiction, or some of the science in it was wrong, but hey, it's science fiction. I mean, it's necessary for the story. I mean, if you wanted to have a totally science factual movie, it couldn't happen at all. And so there has to be some speculation. And it's, you know, the other extreme of that was, you know, this summer I saw, Guardians of the Universe? Guardians of the Galaxy?
Yes.
Yeah, and that, you know, that was a fun movie to watch, but my goodness, the science in it was just so annoying, because they treat, you know, the characters, they go into space, and the only thing they have to protect themselves from the vacuum of space is a mask just covering their face. It's like, yeah, going into the vacuum of space is less dangerous than going underwater even. so that was just quite distracting and annoying on that movie. But this movie was just very Interstellar. I highly recommend it, and especially you want to see it in the theaters, that see it on the big screen.
Yeah, it's on my list, and I've been thinking about you know, figuring out when I can, my wife and I can get away to see that. I was thinking it would be a good, you know, get away for the night kind of thing. Get grandma to watch the kids, you know. Maybe later this month, before it's out of the theaters.
Yep.
And, but yeah, so, no, that's good. Let's see, what have I, see, I have been watching more movies online lately. I a long time ago I started the AFI Top 100 movies list. Mm-hmm. Like, literally, it came out like almost 20 years ago now, and I've been working my way up through it, and I'm on like 47 now. So the most recent one I watched from that is Taxi Driver from 1976.
Did you start from 1 or 100?
I started from 100, working my way towards 1. <one. laughs> And so, like, the first year I was doing like maybe one every few weeks or something, and then I fell off, and then hadn't watched any for a couple of years, and then just in the last couple months I watched number 48 was Jaws.
Really?
Number 48 was, wow. Jaws. So I watched Jaws. I'd never seen Jaws before, so I watched Jaws, and of course I have this thing where, you know, if I see a movie that's part of a series, I have to watch the whole series. So I've actually watched some of the pretty darn horrible Jaws sequels.
Oh man, no, do not do that. No, just see the first one on that one.
Too late.
So you've never known about all these, you know, these cultural references, like you're going to need a bigger boat.
It's these things, you know, you pick up the cultural reference even though you haven't seen the movie. So, like, I knew, you know, you're going to need a bigger boat, and I knew it was from Jaws, but I didn't have all the context around it. Now I have actually seen the movie. the last one from that list I watched was Taxi Driver, which I wasn't too horribly impressed with either, although it won all kinds of awards. But, you know, that sort of 70s gritty movie thing doesn't really do it for me usually.
Yeah, that decade was the Godfather series is great, but I haven't seen Taxi Driver, and I'm not too excited. I've got a long list of movies to see too. I like my Netflix DVD list is over 400 movies long.
Yeah, one of the reasons I moved away from I had a huge Netflix DVD queue, and then I actually reached their maximum.
Really?
I couldn't add any more.
What was it?
It was like 500 or something. Now, they may have increased it since then.
Oh, okay.
But when
I was beginning to the max, so no, what am I going to do?
When I hit that limit, I stopped adding them there and started moving my list, you know, onto the wiki I keep, and I've been slowly moving things off my Netflix queue to the wiki, so I keep my own list now, and I pick things and then I look for them, and so anyway. Enough of that. The one other thing you wanted to review, you have a genealogy widget.
Oh, yeah. Let me bring up the link here. One of the family history sites that I use is called FamilySearch.org. And it is it's a free site put out by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which, full disclosure, I'm a member of. And it's the way that this FamilySearch.org works is it's instead of having your own private database where you have your own tree that you maintain and has only people that you put into it, FamilySearch works where you link in to other people's works.
Right.
So it's one huge tree.
It's one huge tree. Once you have a common ancestor, it just links into whatever work other people have done.
Yeah. Well, and that's conceptually. I mean, I'm sure there are. It may be disjointed in some places, but so anyway, the disadvantages there is that you've got other people working on your quote unquote your line. But the advantage of it is that you can do all kinds of really cool database things. And so one of the things that is out there is it's a site on BYU, and I'll send you a link, and you can probably put in the show notes or if people are interested. It's called Relative Finder. I guess you could Google it and call it Family Search Relative Finder. And once you have your family history in FamilySearch.org, you can link it, or you can go into this website and have it run its database search to see what famous people you're related to and how you're related to them. And my family history goes back pretty far, especially in the United States. As far as I have been able to find, all of my ancestors were here in the U.S. at the time of the Revolution.
Right.
So I'm very lucky in that sense that I have a lot of I'm related to a lot of American famous people. And so I did this search and compared my database to U.S. presidents, and I found that I am related to 15 U.S. presidents. Now, the closest connection is to James Madison. I'm a sixth cousin, nine generations removed. but hey, you know, I can say I'm related to all these presidents. It's really cool. So, and there's also where you can, I can select how I'm related to, you know, famous scientists. Like I'm related to Philo T. Farnsworth, and very, very indirectly. Like 15th cousins or something like that, you can look see how you're related to famous Europeans. I have no famous Europeans because
you've been in this continent too long.
All my people have been here, but when it comes to royalty, I'm a direct descendant of dozens and dozens of kings and stuff because. Now, I'm not sure, you know, the database is not exactly accurate because it's all based on individual people's research, and a lot of people make assumptions once you get past the 1500s or before the year 1500, there's really not any good documentation. There's only royalty that really kept track. And so a lot of people make assumptions. And so, you know, I may or may not be related to that many.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I've found and I haven't gone anywhere near as far as you have on this, but I've had some fun with genealogy stuff too, and even going back, you know, four or five generations, I already find a number of cases where it's like, well, this looks like it's probably what happened, but it's not really 100% sure that's what happened, and you could interpret this thing that way instead, and, well, we have to sort of, well, let's decide which thing we're going to believe.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, that's one of the problems with Family Search is that you get somebody making an assumption, and you can't really go in there and say, unless you can prove that you kind of hesitate, you know, disconnecting the links unless you can prove that that's not really connected.
Right.
And so then you end up being, you get these family trees that have no or very few sources, but a lot of information. Where did they get it from? I have no idea.
Right. And you know, y'all always have to, you know, there are all kinds of sources with different degrees of, it would be nice with these tools to sort of be able to indicate, you know, sort of what percentage sure you are this connection really exists, you know, something like that. Like one of the ancestors I have on mine who has this, 150 page handwritten life story that I have a copy of that I haven't fully digitized. Well, I have the PDF online, but I haven't transcribed it all or read it all. But I know at one place in there is like sort of the copy of the thing from the family Bible or whatever that goes back, you know, the father's 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 father going all the way back to Adam. And, you know, at some point between his dad and Adam, there's stuff in there that's
whenever someone says that they can trace their family tree back to Adam, it is not correct. Absolutely not true.
You see this list and you're like, okay, can we identify at which link in this chain is the link where beyond that it's completely made up?
Yeah, it's called the Dark Ages. And
so anyway, but it's fun stuff, and seeing all these you know, distant relatives identified, that definitely sounds like fun to just see where these people connect to. And with famous people, you always get the armchair genealogist figuring stuff out. Like, if you remember, in 2008, people figured out just how Barack Obama and Dick Cheney were related and things like that. And because there was some connection there, and it's like, okay, that's kind of fun, you know. But anyway, I think we probably have a full show now. We didn't get to talk about any of our reserve topics, so we'll have to wait another time to hear your thoughts on China or climate or anything like that. Thanks a lot for joining us again, Bruce. It's always fun to have you.
It's a real pleasure, and keep up the good work. I really enjoy listening.
Thank you very much. And as usual, anybody can contact me. I'm at abelsmay@abelsmay.com. You can reach me on Twitter at abelsmay. And Bruce, you're at BYU fan.
Yes.
And tell your friends to listen. You know, I'll do that check to see how many people are listening sometime soon.
Well, it may be more this week because I will definitely be Facebooking it so people can hear me on your show.
Well, there you go. So thanks, everybody, for listening, and have a great week, and we'll talk to you again next time. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.